Okay, Numbers chapter 8. The Helotecha, which means when you kindle. The sages often ask, why does this passage open with the verses about the menorah? There's only about four verses here. The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to Aaron and say to him, when you kindle the lamps toward the face of the menorah, shall the seven lamps cast light. Aaron did so toward the face of the menorah. He kindled the lamps as Adonai commanded Moses. This is the workmanship of the menorah. Hammered out gold. From its base to its flower, it is hammered out. According to the vision that Adonai showed Moses, so did he make the menorah. And the question is, what does that have to do with anything else that's in this Torah portion? The rest of the Torah portion is about finally getting the Levites in position, inaugurating and ready to go. Final instructions for breaking camp, how the silver trumpets would be made to signal the people when it's time to march, when it's time to stop, when it's time to go to war, when it's time to assemble the elders, when it's time to have a holy day, time to start Sabbath. What does this bit about the menorah have to do with any of that? And a lot of different ideas have been given. I think the most simplest is this. There are two ways to look at the whole experience in the wilderness of the people of Israel. And we're to look at it in both of these ways. And whichever way you look at it, and as you look at this experience both these ways, we are to remember, as we walk through the wilderness of this life, we are to be lights. And our attention is to be directed towards the face. The Panei Hamnorah. That means that when they put the wicks in the little cups of oil, the wicks would hang out. They wouldn't stick straight up. They kind of hang over. He says, point the wicks toward the middle. It's almost as if these wicks represent little individuals or faces. In fact, they're almonds. And the word for almond and the word for eye are very similar words in Hebrew, because almonds and eyes are shaped the same way. And so this menorah is full of these eyes, these almonds. And it's almost as if we're all as lights of the world. Yeshua says, I'm the light of the world. And he looks at his followers and says, you're lights of the world. But we are to be keeping our attention on him. Did you ever try to look at your own light? Don't. You probably won't see any. And what you do see is your own light probably isn't light at all. Don't look at your own light. Just be light. Just keep your eyes on him. Face him. Let him fill your vision. And as you do that, you'll be lights. When people see you, they're going to say, who are you looking at? And they're going to look to him. Always keep your attention on him as you walk in this world. And I said there are two ways to view this whole teaching, this whole section of the Torah about the walking through the wilderness. The first way is this. You see all these hundreds of thousands of people walking through the wilderness. The way to look at it is to look at yourself as one of those people. And which one are you? Are you one who's always living close to the Lord? Or are you one who whines and grumbles? Are you one who speaks evil of your leader, Moses, or of whatever leader of your congregation, who he may be? Are you one of the ones who dies in the wilderness, you never make it to the promised land? Are you the one of the ones who are faithful? Are you one of the ones who are unfaithful? Are you one of the ones who are looking forward to the land or always looking back at Egypt and how wonderful life was there? Which one are you? That's one way to look at this. Which one of these individual characters in Israel is most like me? But here's another way to look at this, and you are intended to look at this way. The whole group that came out of Egypt, came to Sinai, is moving towards the land. The whole group, the whole people of Israel, also represents each of you. One of the things about Hebraic thought that seems very foreign to us as Greek thinkers is that God treats a whole people, a group of people, as an individual. That's why he calls the whole people of Israel, Israel. Israel is one person. Or he calls them Jacob. Jacob is one person. And he'll often talk about a whole people group as an individual. And the history of that people group as if it were the history of one person. So when you look at the people of Israel in this way, and you see that when they came out of Egypt and came to Sinai, some grumbled and some didn't. And in me, there's part of me that tends to grumble. There's a part of me that says shouldn't be grumbling because God's taken us to the right place. I can identify with both groups. And when I see them leaving Sinai, and then God, as we'll see here a little bit later, that he says, this generation's got to die. You're going to just walk around here for 40 years till that generation that came out is dead, and the young generation grows up to take its place. And I realize in me, there's a part of me that came out of Egypt that's just got to die. It is not suitable for the land of promise to where God's leading me. It's got to go. I have to die. But the new young life is what God wants to raise up and strengthen. There's part of me he wants to strengthen and raise up, and there's part of me he just wants to amputate off and just, that's left here in the wilderness. And then when it's raised up, then they'll go on to the land of fruitfulness. So you understand the two ways to look at this whole series of the Torah, this whole part of the Torah about Israel. You're like one of the people of Israel, but you're like all the people of Israel as well. I know it's difficult to wrap your mind around that, but that's the way Hebraic thought is. What's the verse in Psalms, I think it's Psalm 62, where David says, one thing has God spoken, two things have I heard. And that's the story of how God speaks. He never does one thing at a time. He always accomplishes multiple things at one time. Well, let's be lights in the world. Now, as we come to chapter 8 here, God is giving the order. Let's see. Let's move on. For the sake of time, let's move on. I know where. Chapter 10. Let's go to chapter 10. We looked at last week and the week before how the children of Israel were camped around the tabernacle. It was the center focus. And there were three tribes camped to the east, three to the south, three to the west, three to the north. And then the Levites were divided up into three camps, three families. The family of Merari, the family of Gershon, and the family of Kohath. And each of them were given special responsibilities. One of them is camped on the south, one on the west, and one on the north. And when we come to chapter 10, verse 13, it says, they journeyed for the first time at the bidding of Adonai through Moses. They've been at Sinai for a year now, a whole year. And now finally they're ready to march out. The banner of the camp of the children of Judah journeyed first according to their legions. And over its legion was Nachshon, son of Amminadab. And then it gives some of the other details. Then after these three tribes of Judah, Zebulun, and Issachar, it says in verse 17, the tabernacle was taken down, then journeyed the sons of Gershon and the sons of Merari, the bearers of the tabernacle. So let's get the picture. Now the cloud is moving ahead, the fire, the cloud, and so Judah moves out first with Zebulun and Issachar. Right behind these three tribes are the two Levitical families of Gershon and Merari. Now, they're in charge of all the veils, you know, the curtains of the tabernacle and all the pillars and the sockets. They take all of that down and pack up, and that family of Levi, those two families, Merari and Gershon, they are the next in line. Then in verse 18, then journeyed the banner of the camp of Reuben, according to their legions. And with Reuben are Gad, and Simeon. And then it says in verse 21, after them then journeyed the Kohathites, bearers of the sanctuary. Now Kohath was the family of Levi. Now make sure you get this straight. They are the ones who carried the Ark of the Covenant and the golden altar of incense and the table of showbread and the menorah. All these precious things that go inside of the tabernacle. Got it? They march next. And they, referring to Gershon and Merari, would erect the tabernacle before their, that's Kohath's, arrival. So when the Kohathites arrived, finally at the place, the tabernacle's established, they march in, they put the Ark of the Covenant where it belongs, the menorah, the table of showbread, the golden incense altar, they put everything right there. Greek's prepared and waiting, and there we go. And then in verse 22, then journeyed Ephraim and the two tribes that went with them, Manasseh and Benjamin. And then verse 25, bringing up the rear, because Dan was the largest of the tribes, and they put him in the rear to protect the rear of the group. There's Dan, and with him is Naphtali, and what is the other group? Asher, thank you. Now, here's where the difficulty arises. Where is the ark in this whole process? You got three tribes from the two families of the Levites, then you've got three tribes, and then you've got Kohath right in the middle with the Ark of the Covenant, right? And the menorah and so on. Then you've got three tribes, and that's how they walk through the wilderness. But as you come down a little bit later in the chapter, it says in verse 33, they journeyed from the mountain of Adonai a three-day distance, and the Ark of the Covenant of Adonai journeyed before them a three-day distance to search out for them a resting place. We have a problem. Back in chapter 3, the family of Kohath is specifically given instructions to carry the Ark of the Covenant. And we just read that Kohath is right in the middle of the 12 tribes. There's six tribes ahead of him, six tribes behind him. Kohath is in the middle. And yet here it says the Ark of the Covenant is 3 days ahead of everybody. How can this possibly be? Well, the answer to that question is, this may be news to you. There were two arks. How many knew that there were two arks? Good. This will be new for everybody then. Good. There were two arks made. We're all familiar with the gold ark that had the top on it, the lid with the two cherubim, and the lid's all made of solid gold. And the box itself was made out of acacia wood with gold lining on the inside and gold lining on the outside. But go to Deuteronomy for a second. Deuteronomy chapter 10. Deuteronomy chapter 10. Now, the book of Deuteronomy takes place on the last day of Moses' life. And the word Deuteronomy is not a Hebrew word. It's, I guess, a Greek word. And it's where we get deuto means two. That's where we get the word ditto, okay, make a second of something. And nomos is the Greek word for law. So somehow out of deuteronomos, we get the word Deuteronomy, a second giving of the Torah. In other words, Moses on this last day of his life is rehearsing everything that God has done since he first brought the Israelites out of Egypt. And he refers back to the time when he came down from the mountain with the two tablets, and he saw the people, after those 40 days, he came down and saw the people all sitting with the golden calf. And remember, he threw the tablets down and smashed them. You're all familiar with that, right? Okay. Look at what it says in Deuteronomy 10. We'll start with the first verse. At that time, the Lord said to me, cut out for yourself two tablets of stone like the former ones. Because after Moses gets things ironed out with God, God says, okay, I'll give it to you again. But this time, you cut out the two tablets. I cut out the first two and wrote on them the 10 words. You cut out these two, bring them up to me, and I'll write on them again the 10 words, the 10 commandments. So cut out for yourself two tablets of stone like the former ones and come up to me on the mountain. And look what he says, and make an ark of wood for yourself. I will write on the tablets the words that were on the former tablets which you shattered, and you shall put them in the ark. So I made an ark of acacia wood and cut out two tablets of stone like the former ones, and went up on the mountain with the two tablets in my hand. He wrote on the tablets like the former writing, the 10 words which the Lord had spoken to you on the mountain from the midst of the fire on the day of the assembly, and the Lord gave them to me. Then I turned and came down from the mountain and put the tablets in the ark which I had made, and there they are as the Lord commanded me. Now, This is not the ark that Bezalel made later. Remember, this event that Moses describes is before they had begun construction on the tabernacle and the Ark of the Covenant, the gold one with the cherubim on top. So this is an ark that was made first, just out of plain wood. And he put the tablets in those. But later we know, because the Torah tells us, these tablets were then transferred to the golden ark. In fact, when you read in Hebrews, the writer of Hebrews tells us what's in the ark. The tablets, the two tablets, not the broken ones, but the two new ones that Moses made and God wrote the 10 words on. And then Aaron's staff that blossomed. And then there's a bowl of manna. And according to Jewish history, this is what happened. When the Ark of the Covenant was made, Moses took the two tablets, the two new ones, and they went into the golden ark. And the broken pieces went into the wooden one. So how is it Kohath could be carrying the ark, and yet the ark had journeyed 3 days ahead of them? There were two arks. Well, let's compare these two arks. The wooden ark is plain. But of course, the ark that Bezalel and Aholiab made was made out of wood, covered with gold on the inside, gold on the outside, a solid gold lid with a cherubim on top. The wooden ark is made by Moses, but the golden ark is made by Bezalel. The wooden ark was just in plain view. Anybody can look and say, oh, there's the wooden ark with the broken pieces in it. But the golden ark, did you ever get to see that? It was either at rest inside the Holy of Holies behind the veil, and you didn't get to see it. You know, in fact, only the high priest got to go in there once a year on the Day of Atonement. And when he went in, he really wasn't even supposed to look at the ark. And he would fill the place with the smoke of the incense, and through the smoke of incense, it'd be hard to see anyway. And when the Ark of the Covenant traveled, how was it hidden from view? What did they do? They took the veil, yes, at the temple, at the tabernacle, and they covered the ark with that veil. But the wooden ark was just out in plain view. When they traveled, the first tablets that were made by God and engraved by God were put in the wooden ark. But the second set of tablets that were not broken, the ones that were made by Moses but engraved by God, they were put in the golden ark. The first tablets are broken, the second weren't. And by the way, the question is asked, why did Moses break the tablets? And the answer is given, the tablets were broken and destroyed instead of the people. They deserved to be destroyed, but the tablets were destroyed instead. When Moses came down from Mount Sinai the first time with these tablets, when he smashed them, the people were in rebellion. When he went back up for 40 days and came back with the new tablets, he found the people receptive and at peace and awaiting his arrival. Do you understand what's going on with these two sets of tablets and these two arks? The wooden ark, the one that was made first, represents the first advent of our Messiah. He came, plain Jane, body like this, and the likeness of sinful flesh, Romans 8 tells us. And he came to a people who were in rebellion, and he was broken. But when he returns, he will come in glory to a people who are receptive, and he'll be whole. And it's the same word. Remember, Yeshua is the word that made flesh. And here the flesh is broken, and here it's not. But the word that's on these tablets are identical. It's the same word. It's the same word. That hasn't changed. So when you get the picture here, here's the people of Israel traveling through the wilderness, and the wooden ark is 3 days ahead. It arrives first. And this one's 3 days behind. It's almost as if we travel through this life, we know that ahead of us is the resurrected Messiah. But he's always 3 days ahead. You know, he was in the grave for 3 days. And he's like, it's like we're in this process where he's always on the third day and we're always on the day of death. as we kind of go through this life where this stuff dies. Where we know when we die, he's 3 days right ahead of us, and we will catch up with him. And he's scouting out a place for us, so that where he is, we will be also. And isn't it amazing that the golden ark is covered with a veil? Now remember, the ark had two cherubim on it, and the veil hid the ark from view, didn't it? So even if you somehow managed to get into the holy place, you still couldn't see the ark, because there's the veil between you and the Holy of Holies. And that veil concealed the ark. But what was embroidered onto the veil? Two cherubim. So the veil revealed what was behind it and concealed what was behind it. And the writer of Hebrews says that the veil is the flesh of Messiah. The flesh of Messiah, did it conceal God or reveal God? The answer is yes. Okay? But what happened when Yeshua died? He cried with a great voice and he gave up the Spirit. What happened to that veil? It's torn. And now what was hidden is revealed. You know, when you read the account in Luke, it says he cried with a great voice and the veil in the temple was torn from top to bottom. And the very next verse says that the centurion, the Romans, watched this. Watch what, you know, apparently watched the death of Yeshua. I don't know how he could see the temple at the same time. But he said, surely this is the Son of God. There's something revealed in his heart at that moment. That's almost like Luke put those two verses together. So yes, the physical veil of the temple was torn and the body of Yeshua was torn. But what was revealed then in this man's heart is the true essence of what that veil hid up until that moment that Yeshua died. You follow what I'm saying? And when Yeshua died, the essence of who he was revealed to this Gentile. What a wonderful, powerful picture that is when you think about it. Well, anyways, interesting. So you learned there were two arcs, right? Now, when you go to chapter 10, verses 35 and 36, some of the sages over the millennia have said that these two verses comprise a separate book of Torah. These two verses are a book of Torah all to themselves. Yes, Paul. That's the mystery. It just says it traveled 3 days ahead. No details are given. It's like it was almost completely on its own. All alone. I don't know. That's a question I've got. Yes, Valerie.
Which ark was David?
The gold ark. The golden ark.
So at that time, there was no wooden ark?
I don't find any reference. There could be one. I'm not aware of it. If there are any further references to this wooden ark after the Torah. After you get past Deuteronomy, I'm not sure that's ever referred to again. It may be. Maybe one of you, no, Dale?
Deuteronomy 10:8, just another verse that mm-hmm. doesn't believe like it's always carried that ark around.
The wooden one?
Yes, it says, at that time the Lord said, approach God and believe by the charity of the ark of the covenant of the Lord, to stand before the Lord and minister and pronounce blessing.
Yeah, but is that the wooden one or is that the gold one?
Well, it was just talking about the wooden one. Yeah. I just thought. That
yeah.
Because.
yeah, I don't know. It's a great question.
You know, if you have the Kohathites carrying the gold one, and now you have the Levites, the other one, you just maybe mm-hmm. process
yeah.
That would make me right.
Well, then we'll just say that's the way it is, then. Okay. Well, when you come to Numbers chapter 10, verses 35 and 36, these two verses, which don't seem to have much in connection with what's before and with what's after, they stand alone. It says, when the ark would journey, Moses would say, arise, Adonai, and let your foes be scattered, let those who hate you flee from before you. And when it rested, he would say, return tranquilly, O Adonai, among the myriad thousands of Israel. Now, the reason they say that these two verses are so unusual and could be considered to be a separate book of Torah is because, and I know this print's kind of small, I should have blown this up a bit, but if you look carefully, you'll notice that there are two brackets. You're reading along, and then you come to the end of verse 34, then there's this long space, then there's an upside-down letter none. Now, sometimes it's printed backwards, or in some scrolls, upside down. But it's just the letter none, just hanging out there by itself. And then you have verses 35 and 36. When you get to the end, there's another inverted none right there. When I say inverted none, don't get this picture of a Catholic woman hanging by her heels. That's not what I mean. It's the letter none, a long space, and then it continues. And they say these two verses are so unique and so important that God ordained that in the Torah scrolls, they are bracketed and set apart from the rest of Torah. And if these are considered to be a book of Torah all by themselves, that would make the book, the Torah go from five books to seven books. Because you've got Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, there's three. You've got this first part of Numbers, which ends here. That makes four. Then you've got this book of Torah, which is five. Then you've got the rest of the book of Numbers, which is six. And then you have Deuteronomy, which would make the seventh book. And when the Bible talks about wisdom being established on seven pillars, maybe that's what it's referring to. Who knows? It's all speculation. But one of the interesting things here is that the letter nun, the word nun, means fish. And the letter is shaped to remind people, at least it did back then, of a fish. So we have these two verses bracketed by two fish. And what's interesting about this is that when you read what comes before verse 35, you see the invitation going to the Gentiles. Because what does Moses say? He speaks to his father-in-law and invites him to travel with him. And it would appear, even though at first Jethro says no, it would appear that Jethro and his family did go with Moses. Now later on, when you get to the book of Judges and other places, you find the descendants of Jethro living in the land. But then right after verse 36, when you get into chapter 11, verse 1, what do you find? You find judgment coming. So it's almost as if you've got this section coming up here that ends with the invitation of the Gentiles. And then you skip over 35 and 56, and you see judgment coming. And then you see these two verses bracketed by two fish. It's almost like God's giving us a little hint in the jots and tittles of Torah to refer to this 2,000-year period called the Age of the Gentiles. Just a thought. And what comes before the Age of the Gentiles? The invitation to the Gentiles. What comes immediately after the Age of the Gentiles? Judgment. Because what does it say in 11:1? The people took to seeking complaints. It was evil in the eyes and the ears of Adonai. Adonai heard, and his wrath flared, and a fire of Adonai burned against them. So we see fiery judgment coming next upon the earth. It's just a thought. It's kind of interesting. But this unique 2,000-year period in which we find ourselves, and we find ourselves near the end of it, I'm not claiming any years, okay? It could be another 50, 100, 500 years, I don't know. But we do know that it's been almost 2,000 years since Messiah was here. Not quite, but almost 2,000. And there are several hints of this 2,000-year period in Scripture. Should I show you one real quick? Go to, I'm glad somebody said yes, since I was going to show it to you anyway. It's in the book of John. Go to John for a moment, and go to chapter 4. John chapter 4. In chapter 3, Messiah is talking to Nicodemus, one of the leaders of the Jews. In chapter 5, we see Yeshua once again going up to Jerusalem because it's one of the Moedim. But in chapter 4, we see him speaking to a Gentile, a woman at a well, a Samaritan. And this is unusual, and I'm sure you've heard all the teachings about this, how unusual it is for a Jewish man alone to be alone with a woman, especially a Gentile woman, especially with a Gentile woman like this, who morally apparently is kind of loose as a sinner, and to be alone with her and talking with her, engaging her in conversation. But what's fascinating to me is the conversations he has with her is much deeper than the one he had with Nicodemus, one of the leaders of the Jewish generation. So anyways, he has this conversation with this woman. And this is the only place in the Gospels that I'm aware of where Messiah specifically comes out and tells someone that, yes, I'm the Messiah. Because the woman says, let's see, verse 25, the woman said to him, I know that Messiah is coming. He was called Christ. When that one comes, he will declare all things to us. And what does Yeshua say to her? I who speak to you am he. I don't know of any other place in the Gospels where he comes out and says, I'm the Messiah. Except to her, a Gentile woman. And then she runs off back to town to tell all her friends and enemies, I guess. She's probably more enemies than friends. But to tell them that I found the Messiah. And then they come back with her. And let's pick it up in verse 42. Verse 41. Many more believed because of his word. The verse 39. I'm sorry. I'm really bad about backing up here. From that city, many of the Samaritans believed in him because of the word of the woman who testified. He told me all the things that I have done. So when the Samaritans came to Yeshua, they were asking him to stay with them. And he stayed there 2 days. Many more believed because of his word. And they were saying to the woman, it is no longer because of what you said that we believe. For we have heard for ourselves and know that this one is indeed the Savior of the world. After the 2 days, he went forth from there into Galilee. So twice we're told he spent 2 days. Not one, not three, two. It's a picture. It's a hint. It's one of these little hints found in Scripture about this period of the Gentiles. Yeshua specifically commands his disciples, do not go among the Gentiles. Only go to the lost sheep of Israel. And yet here Yeshua by himself goes to the Gentiles for 2 days. And then he returns to Israel. Just an interesting little hint. And there are others scattered throughout the scriptures. But that's one of my favorites. Well, as soon as the people of Israel start traveling, it's just a downhill spiral. They start complaining. And there are three main events that take place. The first one starts in chapter 11, verse 1, and we just read how they just started complaining, started griping. It doesn't tell us what they're griping about, but I found most people don't need a reason to gripe. They're going to gripe, and they'll just take whatever's handy. We've all been that way. You're in a foul mood. You're going to gripe. You're going to complain. And whatever is close at hand is the one that becomes the target of your complaint. Isn't that true? That the spirit of complaint is there, present, before there's an excuse to claim, to complain. But when you're in a great mood, something can go wrong, but it's like, you know, that's fine, it's okay. It's like zippity-doo-dah, zippity-yay. You know, it's everything's wonderful. So we need to be careful of this spirit of complaint. And look what it says in verse 4. The rabble. Now that's what my Orthodox Jewish translation says, the rabble. It really means the mixed multitude. And the word that's used there in Hebrew is the asafsef. Asafsef. It's the only place it's found in Torah, the asafsef. The collected collection. There's a collection of people from all backgrounds. In other words, there's Gentiles mixed in here. So they call it the rabble. That was among them. Look what it says. They cultivated a craving. They cultivated a craving. They craved a craving. It's the Hebrew and the noun form of the same word mixed together. And the children of Israel also wept once more and said, "Who will feed us meat? We remember the fish that we ate in Egypt free of charge, and the cucumbers, melons, leeks, onions, and garlic. But now our life is dried up." The word there for parts is the same word for raisin. It's just dried up, shriveled up. "There is nothing. We have nothing to anticipate but the manna." Think about this for a second. How wicked this was, and yet how we've all done this. It says the rabble cultivated a craving. In other words, the people weren't craving meat until someone came along and says, "Boy, wouldn't a steak taste great right now? Oh, remember the fish back in Egypt? Oh, man, and the leeks and the garlic and the onions and the melons for dessert. Oh, didn't mention the slavery and the beatings and the death and destroying the baby boys. They just kind of skip right over that. But this craving was cultivated by a rabble. Be careful who you hang with, is all I can say. Because when you hang around people who are discontent, it's much more likely they're going to spread that discontent to you more than you're going to spread content to them. Be careful who you hang with. When you hang with negative people, it tends to rub off. I mean, I used to go to the teacher's lounge when I was teaching, and guess what they would do? Every stinking day, complain. Sprinkled around in here and there, there might be a compliment about somebody, but they go right back to the complaining, the sarcasm, and the derogatory remarks, the Lashon Hara, rawr, just constantly. Then we all go back to our classes. And the next day, same thing. Robin just got a job working at an assisted living home. She worked a couple days a week, and she says, "I don't even go in the lounge because it's the same thing there." How many of you experience the same thing where you work? Is there a lounge where people eat? Isn't that interesting? Well, no, they griped one day and then they were happy and, you know, praise everybody the next day is kind of 50-50. That makes sense, but it's consistent. It always gravitates to complaints and griping. Be careful who you hang out with. When you hang out with negative people, you will see the world in a negative way. I have a little story here. I came across, I think, is really good. One about positive speech. One of the best pieces of advice someone once gave me was catch your kids being good. I thought, wow, I'm so good at catching them being bad. I go to my way to catch them being bad, so I could bring the wrath of God against them. And the fear and admonition of the Lord, that's what I'm supposed to raise them in. But somebody said, catch them being good. I never thought of that. So I thought, well, good is just normal. You know, that's the way it's supposed to be. The bad is abnormal. That's what I need to address. But positive speech is powerful. So is negative speech. But this is a true story about a slaughterhouse in South America. There's a kosher slaughterhouse. There's a large Jewish community in South America. And there was a slaughterhouse, a kosher slaughterhouse, managed by a man named Mr. Samo. And every night, it says, prior to closing, he would check to make sure everything was in order. One night, as he was about to lock up, Alex, the night watchman, approached him and implored him not to leave. "Mr. Samo, you cannot close up because there's still someone a butcher, in the building." "Alex," Mr. Samuel responded, "I have been checking this building for years. Trust me, there's no one left inside." "Please, Mr. Samuel," entreated Alex, "I am certain that he is still in here." Mr. Samuel relented and thoroughly checked the building. Upon returning, he told Alex, "The building is empty. There is no one left inside. I'm closing up." No, you cannot do this, Alex emphatically declared. I have no doubt whatsoever that the slaughterer is somewhere in the building. You must check again. Okay, Alex, but this is the last time I will check the entire building. Indeed, Mr. Sammo was moved by his watchman's overwhelming concern for the butcher. If he could care so much, the least he could do is look one more time. Mr. Sammo returned and searched every nook and cranny in the building and found no one. As he walked by the large meat freezer, he thought to himself, this freezer is huge enough to hold a person. What if the slaughterer entered the freezer and the door closed on him? Let me take a look and see. Who knows? One can only imagine the shock that overcame Mr. Sammo when he opened the door to discover not one, but three workers. Ritual slaughterers, nearly frozen to death. He quickly called an ambulance and the three were rushed to the hospital. Apparently, earlier that day, the shoktim, that's the Hebrew word for a ritual slaughterer, had entered the freezer to check the meat, and the door slammed shut. The three slaughterers entered. They banged and yelled for hours to no avail, but finally gave up and resigned themselves to a certain frozen death. It was just then that Mr. Samuel came and discovered them. A few days later, after the slaughterers were released from the hospital, Mr. Samuel approached Alex and asked him, how did you know for sure that something was amiss, that a slaughterer had not left the building? Furthermore, if you knew about one slaughterer, surely you also knew about the other two. Alex responded with a deep sense of pride. Ever since those men arrived from Israel a few months ago, one of them has gone out of his way to greet me in the morning and bid me good night at the end of the day. His sincerity and good cheer have been the hallmark of my day. Never did he miss a day. That day, I remembered that he had greeted me in the morning, but had not wished me good night. That is how I knew that he had not yet left the premises. I had no idea that the others were also excited. So this man's positive speech, his joy, he took this Jewish principle that you owe it to others to be happy. He took it very seriously. To be joyful, to have a joyful countenance, to notice the people around him, to speak words of encouragement to them. Saved his life and the life of two other men. Don't ever underestimate the power of positive speech, the power of a kind word. Don't ever do that. Well, after the hungering for the meat. And there's an amazing lesson here for us. It says that they hungered for basar, for flesh. And when we read this, we have to realize that every one of us has an appetite for flesh. We're to be feeding upon something spiritual, the manna. And Yeshua himself says, I am the bread that came down out of heaven. And he calls himself the manna. He refers to himself as that. But we have this appetite for flesh as well. It seems like we never get tired of the flesh, of eating flesh, but we do get tired of the spiritual food. And we have to realize that there is in the world today, and has been for quite a while, but it's very prevalent in the world today, in many congregations, a very fleshly component. When people say, well, you know, this service is good, but I really enjoy such and such a congregation. I enjoy it because they do such and such. I enjoy this and that. And what they're enjoying has nothing to do with teaching or prayer. It usually has to do with some kind of fleshly display. Do you know you're to be part of a congregation not because you enjoy it? But you're to be a part of a congregation and a worship service because God enjoys it. We are not here, and I'm not here for you to have fun. I hope you and I are here for the same reason, because it brings pleasure to our Father's heart. There are a lot of things I can do to have fun that are clean and fine. But when I come here, and when we worship and it's very quiet, and when we concentrate and focus in prayer, and there's silence, maybe a little music, it's not for the satisfaction of this stuff, this flesh. It's to be the satisfaction of our Father's heart. These people were hungry for flesh. God says, you want flesh? I'll give you flesh. And he brought the quail. And he says, you'll have so much flesh, it'll be coming out your nose. And it says that when he brought the wind, and that's interesting, the word for wind there is the word ruach, spirit. And so much that passes for being done in the name of the Spirit of God has nothing to do with the Spirit of God. It's emotion. It's just flesh. I just happen to think of something. You know, I've been in churches where there's all this fleshly display. All right? Fleshly display. And it seems like you can almost set your watch. Once they have the invocation, you can almost set your watch. Okay, 35 minutes, they're going to be all kind of doing this and yelling, screaming, and falling on the floor and barking and howling, speaking in tongues and whatever. You can almost set your watch. You can tell the Holy Spirit's going to move in 35 minutes from now. I remember watching a program on television where some scientists got a group of college kids together. And these college kids all volunteered gladly for this test because they were going to be put in a room, guys and girls, there were about a dozen of them, put in a room. There were cameras, so they knew they were on camera. And the people running the experiment were going to bring in beer for all the kids. And so everybody used to drink a beer together at the same time. They drank the beer, and they would just chit-chat with one another, talk, whatever. And then in about 10 minutes, they bring in a second beer. Everybody has a second beer. And 10 minutes later, they bring a third beer, and then a fourth, and a fifth, until everybody gets drunk. And then they would stop the beer, and they just want to watch what happened as the people sobered, and they just wanted to capture this on film, and the kids are told, just be yourselves, whatever. So they bring in the first beer, everybody drinks it, and they're all happy, wait for the second. The second beer comes in, they drink that, and they're starting to get loose, and third beer, fourth beer, fifth beer, and one girl says, man, I'm getting so lightheaded, I'm getting so drunk. The other one says, oh man, I can't even stand up. And they're all just starting to get sloshed, right? So they go through this whole thing, and after about 30 minutes, the scientist walks in, asks them how they're feeling. They're oh man, I'm so wigged out, I'm so drunk, I'm so this or that. And he says, I have news for you. That was non-alcoholic beer that we just served you. You wouldn't believe how quickly these kids all sobered up. Okay, they're all sober. You understand, because they expected to get drunk, they got drunk. And what can happen is that, can God move upon people in a powerful way? Of course he can. He can do whatever he wants. He's God. But the thing is, when we try to repeat something over and over and over again, God doesn't even have to be in the room, and we'll go through all the motions. Because our flesh gets trained to respond. I never want to be that. I never want to have such an appetite for flesh that I become one of these who misses the land of promise because I craved a fleshly experience. One of the things I want you to notice in the scriptures, every time God moved in a powerful way upon an individual or a group, they were not expecting it. They were not looking for it. But when you find someone looking for an experience, God denies it. Because Yeshua says, an evil and adulterous generation seeks after a sign, something they can see. Let's be very careful what we look for. Let's be very careful what we develop an appetite for. And then the third great failure is in chapter 12. A hunger for power, complaining against Moses. Miriam and Aaron get in cahoots. Isn't it interesting? It's two of them together. I just have a feeling that by themselves, Miriam or Aaron by themselves would not have had the guts to complain against Moses. But together, there's this camaraderie in rebellion. There's this camaraderie in evil speech that gives us the courage to do something we'd never do by ourselves. And they complain against Moses. And as George shared with us in the Torah service, described how Miriam was struck with zaras, with leprosy, the skin disease. And she was rejected to the outside of the camp for 7 days. I was reading through some old Torah Club notes, and I want to share this with you because I think it's it addresses this issue so well. The incident of complaining happens when a nostalgia for the food of Egypt sweeps over the camp. Oh, this is actually about the... Let's see. I'm in the wrong place. Here we go. This is about the pattern of destruction. It says, the pattern is a familiar one. Human behavior, being what it is, always drifts towards discontentment and criticism. This is actually a God-given function of the human soul. We live in a fallen world, and we are to partner with God in the process of repairing the world. That's tikkun olam. In order to do so, we need a critical faculty that can detect flaw and imagine improvement. You follow me? Okay. Therefore, we recognize shortcomings and do what we can to correct them and improve things. However, this God-given impetus to recognize problems has malfunctioned within us. Under sin's influence, our natural ability to discern a problem has been warped to become a critical, self-serving spirit, which discerns problems as things that contradict our own will and whim. No matter how good our lives are, we will find reason for discontentment and unhappiness. We are quick to observe that every silver lining has its cloud. Our shrewd powers of analysis are able to detect imperfections and character deficits in every single human being we meet. No matter what the situation, we can always find something to complain about. As Western culture drifts even further away from values like loyalty and commitment, this basic flaw of human nature is working havoc in every human institution. A critical spirit of ingratitude and discontentment eventually destroys jobs, marriages, families, and congregations. The book of Numbers is very much concerned with correcting this errant human tendency toward complaining, discontentment, and criticism. In each of the stories, we are told how the children of Israel complained about one thing or another, and then we are told that God heard it. The first thing we are to learn from these stories is that God is listening. Before we open our mouths to complain or criticize, we need to remember that God is listening. Based upon the stories of the book of Numbers, it would appear that few things irritate God more than a negative attitude. A cynical, critical heart is a wrong heart. He has a zero tolerance policy toward complainers. As I was thinking about this, I was reminded of the passage in Matthew chapter 7, where the Master commands us to beware of wolves in sheep's clothing. Because you see, one of the things that's very lacking today is discernment. Discernment. What's sad is that everybody thinks they have it, but very few do. They think that because they can look at flaws and criticize them, therefore, I'm a discerning person. And I had an opportunity last night of talking to a group of the young adults here from Beth Tikkun. I don't know how I managed to get into the party. I guess they just didn't check my ID. I didn't see that I was too old to be there, but I was there. And I didn't plan to share this tonight, but we had a great conversation together. And after a conversation, I thought, well, I'll share this with you. So I'm going to go off topic for a second. We're going to check your discernment. Now, you young folks who were there last night, you have to zip it, okay? Don't give this away. Question, who is this man? Okay? To the starving, he offered a miraculous supply of food. I'm going to give you four things about this man. To the starving, he offered a miraculous supply of food. To the despised, rejected, and humiliated, he offered deliverance. To the homeless, he offered mansions. To the condemned, he promised rescue. Who is it? Sure, right? Satan. You see, Yeshua tells us The way you recognize a false prophet, a wolf in sheep's clothing, is not by their behavior. Because these are four things that Satan did. When he tempted Yeshua, Yeshua is starving, he says, hey, turn the rocks into bread. Go eat. He was on the side of Yeshua's appetite. And then he takes Yeshua to the pinnacle of the temple. Now, in the Talmud, there's a prophecy that when the Messiah comes, he will descend from the pinnacle of the temple. So Satan takes Yeshua to the pinnacle of the temple and says, listen, just jump off. You won't bruise your heel against a stone. You have that promise. And the idea is that here are all the Jewish leaders, the Pharisees, the Sadducees, the Sanhedrin, they're all right there. You jump off, you float to the ground. You avoid the rejection. You avoid the humiliation, the torture, the death. They will embrace you as the Messiah. Isn't that what you want? And then he takes them to a great and high mount, shows them all the kings of the world. And Satan says, these are mine, and I may give them to who I will. And Yeshua didn't argue with it. He says, they're yours. Bow down and worship me. You see, if you just look at behaviors of a person, you will not discern a false prophet. Because all you're going to look at is sheep's clothing. That's what sheep's clothing is. It's the behaviors. It's the words. It's the niceties, the pleasantries, the discussion of Torah, the discussion of this and that. They wear the sheep's clothing well. He says it's by their fruit that you know them. And that's a different thing than just behaviors. Discernment comes from looking at a person's fruit. You see, in a short period of time, Satan could come up to Yeshua and act like his friend. Oh, and how about the fourth one? The fourth one comes through Peter. Remember when Yeshua revealed to his disciples that we have to suffer and die at the hands of the Pharisees? Yeshua said, oh, far be it from you, Lord. No. That can't happen to you. And Yeshua looks at him and says, get behind me, Satan, for you savor the things of man and not the things of God. You see, I assure you that if Satan wanted to make his way into our congregation to do damage, he would come in the way that you would love to see someone come into our congregation. He would come in very modest looking. He would come in very knowledgeable of the word. He would come in complimenting you and having high praise for the congregation and for the individuals. And you would just think, oh, this guy is just great, an angel of light. Because you see, Satan himself knows how to put on the sheep's clothing well. Oh, he knows how to tailor make it, and he will put on sheep's clothing like none you've ever seen before. But it's not by their clothing you recognize, it's not by their behavior that a false prophet is recognized, it's by their fruit. Fruit takes time. You see, if you just look at Satan for a few events there, you can't discern he's Satan. You look at the big picture, it's obvious. You know, I could have made another overhead that had Yeshua as the answer and put in some very negative things. And you would never dream it was him. Like, he comes to a party and brings six big kegs of hooch. I mean, I could just go on and on and on. He was a man who was violent in the congregation. He disrupted the service. He was disrespectful to spiritual authorities. I could go on and on and on of behaviors that you think, oh my goodness, this is the devil himself. It's not, it's the Messiah. How do you measure fruit? Because by their fruits, you'll know them. It's the only way. The fruits are these. When you step back, you step away from this person who up close can be so attractive and so warm and so knowledgeable, so good, and just so embraceable. When you step back, what are the relationships he has? What are the relationships he has with his family? What kind of relationships does he have with other believers? What is his history with people that he's known? People who were close to him a year ago or 2 years ago, are they close to him now? You always look at relationships, because your fruit is really your relationships with people. That's why Yeshua says, you abide in me, my words abide in you, you will bear much fruit. Got that? You and me and you? Relationship is the fruit of a person's life. When you're with this person, do you find yourself more contented with your lot in life, or more discontented with your lot in life? When you're with this person, do you tend to be drawn away into criticism of all that's bad and wicked and evil? And then later you think, wait a minute, should I have really been criticizing that? Is that really that bad, that wicked, that evil? Step back. Look at the big picture. What is the fruit of this person's life over the whole period of time I know about him or her? That is the fruit you look at. I mean, if you see an angel of light, right away you think it's an angel of light. You step back and look at the whole experience. What's the fruit? And trust me on this. Every fruit has seed in it. Good seed or bad seed. Be careful who you embrace. Be careful who you draw near to. Because not all sheep are sheep. And the only way you can know there's a wolf underneath the clothing is by the fruit of their lives. What has it produced over the long run? Don't look at the behaviors. Because you might see somebody really annoys you and bad behavior, but over the long run might turn out to be one of the most wonderful people you could ever have in your life. And other people just seem like they're so loving, so good, and so nice, and so warm, and so knowledgeable. Might be running with wolves. Okay? I don't know how else to put it than that. But boy, we have to look under the surface, people. We've got to do it. And you think, well, how many wolves are out there running around sheep's clothing? Well, a lot of them. In 1 John 2, he tells us there are many false prophets going out through the world. Many, 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 many. Okay? And we'll all run into them. You all will. You will all encounter wolves in sheep's clothing, every single one of you. Be discerning. Look under the surface. Okay? Look under the surface. Know who you're dealing with. Your very life may depend on it, and the life of your spouse and your children. It's extremely important. Be careful who you hang with, because they will influence you. We're all connected somehow. So be very discriminating with who you embrace and who you let into your life. Now, I can look across this room, and I know all of you, and I know many of you very well. And I look over here, and I can look at these lives and say, there's not one person I see here that I wouldn't want to spend a lot of time with. There's not one of you here that I would say would be a bad influence on me. You might not feel the same way about me, but I don't think you'd do me much harm. You're wonderful, good people, and I take very seriously the two jobs God's given me. Feeding you, which is the fun, easy part, and protecting you. And the only way I know to protect you is to give you warnings. To give you warnings. And because that's what I will be held accountable for when I stand before God. He's given me this work to do. So I want to feed you the best I can, but I need to protect you the best I can. And since I'm not with you 24/7, I need to give you warnings, try to equip you with a spiritual radar that will protect you and your family from spiritual destruction. Because you will find wolves. Here's another thing to notice. Sheep feed on the Word of God. Wolves may know the Word of God, but they feed on sheep. Wolves will draw individuals away. They can never be part of a large flock because they're a different nature. But they will draw people away from a flock after themselves. That's the nature of the wolf. You separate, but then you feed upon them. And they suck you dry. They suck all your joy, your life, your strength, your contentment away. They leave you an empty shell and they move on. I've seen it happen over and over and over and over again. And every time, it was preventable if the person had discernment. I love you guys so much, it hurts. And I just want to see anyone here deceived by a wolf and sheep's clothing. Okay? All right. Any comments or questions? Ooh, we've run over. Any comments or questions before we close? Yes, John.
I have a comment for the well, you said that to cease and desist group takes time. And it's interesting to me how some people think that they can judge whether somebody is spiritually good or spiritually bad right away. And it makes me wonder where their mindsets are.
Some people have that ability. They can tell right away. But everybody can tell over time if they'll just take the time to really study and really look. And I'm going to ask you to complain and to criticize one another, but know who people are. There are spiritual dangers in this world. There are spiritual wolves running around in spiritual clothing, sheep's clothing. And they're deadly. And they're destructive. Terribly destructive. And the wolves that don't look like sheep, you don't have to worry about. It's the ones that you don't recognize. The ones that look like sheep, those are the ones you have to worry about. They sit right in the midst and they scatter the flock. Yes, Robin.
That's what I'm trying to figure out. Some people can misunderstand if they sheep, or why not hang out with on sheep?
No. Yes. Right. Good point. Oh, yeah. Like, I can't hang with you. You're not holy enough. Right. That's not what we're talking about. Yes. Yeah, they're exactly. I'm so glad you brought that up. I'm just talking about not hanging with people who are wolves. No person's not a wolf before you start spending a lot of time with them. And when you meet someone new, you know, your first job number one, is not to believe every spirit. Job number two is to test it. And too many times, people try to test the spirits before they've not believed the spirit. You know what? You know what I'm saying? John gives us clear instruction. Do not believe every spirit. So when I hear something new and meet someone new and they just claim to be all gung-ho for the Lord, you know, and praise God. It's like, first of all, I'm not going to think, all right, I don't know you. I don't know if this is just cheap thought. I don't know if you even know God. So first of all, I'm not going to accept at face value you're this hot on fire believer that you kind of come off as. I'm not going to believe that. But we'll see. You got it? We'll see. If you're who you claim to be, it'll become obvious. But I'm just going to throw my lot in with you and just accept that you are who you pretend to be. Maybe you are. Praise God if you are. But I need to see some fruit. I just need to take a wait and let's see time. So don't believe every spirit. And then you're free to test them. And your test is going to be valid after you've chosen not to believe. But then you can choose to believe it or not. But too many times we believe something's right, and then we'll think, well, I'll go and test it just to confirm what I already think. Too late. Too late. You're already deceived. Yes, David.
Greg, would you expound on this? Try every spirit to see if it professes Yeshua as Messiah.
Yeah.
Jesus as the Christ.
Yeah. Anybody can say that with their mouths.
Right.
Yes. So talk is cheap. Confess or profess in Hebraic thought always means something that comes forth from the life, not just from the mouth. And so it takes time. It takes time. Yes, yes. Things prove themselves over time. But we're too impatient to embrace or reject. And we need to see people's fruits. Everybody produces fruit. It's just either it's good or bad, one or the other. You know, when Yeshua talks, it says every tree is known by its fruit. You know, if you show me the bark of a tree, I can't tell you what kind of tree it is. And if you show me the leaves of a tree, I might have a better guess. But if you show me an apple, I know that's an apple tree. There's no question now. So when the fruits come out, all doubt is removed. But remember, fruits are not necessarily the momentary behaviors. The fruit is what comes out of time spent in the presence of another. If something develops over time, It's the product of the life itself. I can think of an individual I know. And this person is just a blast to be with. You can't be with this person without being just laughing. I mean, they're such wonderful humor. And they would talk about God, and we would laugh, and so on and so forth. But over the years, I've known this person now for probably close to 20 years. We've lost contact. But over the 20 years, I can step back and look. Every single relationship this person's ever had has ended in shipwreck. With the spouse, with the kids, with neighbors, with brothers and sisters, with friends, and he's brought pain and destruction to every relationship that this person has had, every single one, and has brought division and discontent and pain, and it's terrible when you look at the fruit. Now, that person you spend 5 minutes with and you just love them. They're just so fun to be with. They step back and look at the fruit. It's bad fruit. Bad fruit. Yes, dear. We'll give you the last word. Are you serious?
I'm totally serious.
Wow.
The fruit tree kept the fruit longer.
Yeah.
The non-fruit tree, no.
Yeah. So, wow. Never heard that before. I'm not going to believe that, but I will test it to see if it is. Yeah. That's fascinating. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, in the spiritual realm, everybody bears fruit. Everybody bears fruit. But it's going to be good or it's going to be bad. But it all has seeds. It all will reproduce itself. We just need to be careful. Rich, you had your hand up, didn't you? Now that I think of it.
I was just going to mention that we talked about having wolves in our homes and being careful about that sort of thing. And I'm becoming more and more sensitive to how many times I have a wolf in my house
for the television.
Mm.
Yeah. Yes. Right. And those aren't with sheep's clothing. They're just fangs bared and drool and the whole thing. They're just right there. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. That's true. Oh my, more hands. Ken. We'll get Ken and then Peter. Yes, Ken. Well, the fig tree. That's another story. That's another story. No. Yeah, that fig tree represents that generation of Israel, and they quit bearing the good fruit. Got lots of leaves. You can't eat leaves. There's no life given from that tree. We'd be life givers. So, yes, Peter. Yes.
Yes.
Right. Yeah, our problem is we made a wolf in sheep's clothing. We don't want him to be a wolf. We like this person so much. We don't want to even accept the possibility they're a wolf. Well, that's how they lure you. They got you. They got you. And then on the other hand, I know with kids, when they hit their teens, they treat their parents like an enemy. The kids, you don't have any better friend on this earth than your mom and dad. And, but boy, we treat them like enemies. Yeah, so true. We've got to close, or else we'll just go into a morning service. Okay? So, Father, thank you so much for your word. I pray you take the stumbling speech and the words and thoughts, and Father, weave them together into something that will help us and protect us, that will give us wisdom and light in our walk. Lord, I pray that every person here be protected because they have discernment and they will know how to resist the one who comes as a sheep but isn't. Lord, help us to know the true nature of things and of people. Let us not reject anything that's good, but Lord, let us not embrace anything that's dangerous and evil and harmful to us. Help us to know the difference. And Lord, I pray that as we go through this life, we would not be like those we read about in our portion this week, who grumble and complain and sow discontent among others. Well, Lord, let us realize we are on a journey to a land that flows with milk and honey. So, Father, even though the journey can be difficult, let us face it with courage and with goodwill and with joy. May you be pleased with our walk, Father, as we get to know you better. And we praise you in the precious name of Yeshua. Amen.